MacCast, Wednesday, June 15th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. It's been a little while since we've talked. I was on vacation. I had a nice break, went up to the central coast of California, did some camping. Thought I'd come back all relaxed and rested, but I came back, as you often do from vacations, having to jump right into the thick of things and get back into it. I had obviously missed WWDC. I was there, hunkered down at a Starbucks for the announcements, so I was able to watch the keynote and kind of follow along with the live blogs and what have you. And so I got the pertinent information, but didn't have much time to dig in deeper than that. So promptly when I returned, I had about 1,500 articles to go through in my news feed. There's been a lot of chatter about what was announced at WWDC, and as there should be, there was a lots of stuff announced. We have Lion coming out here in July. We've got iOS 5 due out in the fall. And then the big announcement of iCloud and some of the services for iTunes, the iTunes Music Match service, and all that stuff that goes on top of it. I know you want to hear about my thoughts and opinions on things. I have parsed through all of the WWDC fallout. Have a lot of information and details that I've aggregated from different sources, so we're going to do that in this episode. Also have some feedback from you, some great hints and tips and tricks and stuff like that toward the end. So hang in for all of that, but before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and recognize one of our show sponsors, Stitcher. They make an application called Stitcher Smart Radio, and it's free, available in the Mac App Store. They also have it for your Android devices if you want to get it over there. And it allows you to listen to podcasts and radio streaming on your smartphones and iOS devices. You can get the MacCast on there. It's available in the directory. Just download the free app. And what's great about it is it's streaming over 3G, over Wi-Fi. So you don't have to remember to sync up your iPhone before you leave the house or your iPad. You can actually just go in there and grab your favorite podcast. You can mark them as your favorites. It'll give you notifications when new episodes are available, and you can just jump in there and start listening right away. Just hit the little play button. A lot of the other podcasts that I'm on are in there. We have Communicators, Mac Roundtables. You can check out all of those, and you can add in your favorite local or not local radio stations. They have a huge listing of radio stations that you can listen to. So if you enjoy listening to the radio, talk radio, music, what have you, you can listen in on that. And so when new episodes are available, just grab them right away. And not only is the application free to download on the App Store, but for a limited time, they're giving new listeners a chance to win an iPad 2. So if you go to stitcher.com/MacCast, they'll have the details there. You can even sign up to get an email reminder about downloading the application. But just go on the App Store, download the app, and when you sign up for the service, when you register, enter the code MacCast, and you'll be automatically entered to win the iPad 2. It's a very easy, quick thing to do, easy sign-up process. That's Stitcher, STITCHER.com/MacCast for the details. And a big thank you to Stitcher for their support of the MacCast. So WWDC happened last week. Apple made all of their big announcements, iCloud, Mac OS X Lion, or I guess it's just called OS X Lion now. They dropped the Mac part, which there's probably some significance there with relationship or with respect to what they talked about at the WWDC event. And then also they showed off some new features in iOS 5. Because they were covering so many things, they just focused on 10 features in each area. And if you haven't had a chance to check it out, they do have the full event available on the website or through their keynote podcast in iTunes. So you can watch the whole thing in case you didn't follow along. But I'm assuming you know most of the broad-reaching details. What I thought I'd do is kind of dig into some of the additional information and stuff that's come out since the announcements were made. So iCloud, I think, was the big one. That was the one they saved for the end. It's the new edition, and Apple and Steve Jobs said they're demoting the Mac to being just another device, and iCloud's sort of going to be the hub or the center of where we're going to connect all of our Apple and Mac devices to. And so I think it's really more significant than you might expect. A lot of people were just seeing it as sort of an upgrade to Mobile Me. It's really going beyond that. Apple is declaring, in some respects, what they say, the death of the file system. The file system's been around with us for a very long time, using files, and that whole metaphor was the foundation of the graphic user interface. And Apple is using iCloud to kind of reimagine and rethink that. And I think we saw some of it starting with how file management is handled on iOS. And it's been a little bit clunky. I think there's going to be some growing pains, and we're going to have to work through some things. But Dan Morin over at Macworld wrote a piece that really points out the significance of the placement of iCloud in the keynote. It was on equal footing with iOS and macOS 10. And so it kind of shows that Apple is looking at that, at this piece, as being just as important as the operating systems, which, when you stop to pause and really ponder that, it really is a big change. Apple is thinking forward, and I think we've only seen some little glimpses of what this is going to mean, but they want to really revolutionize and change the idea of a file system. File-aware apps, I think, is the direction that they're going in, like we've seen on iOS, where you open up the application, and the application displays the relevant data and files that you need to consume within that application. The storage location, actually where it is, whether it's in the cloud or on your desktop or on a network storage volume, should really become irrelevant at that point. The application should know where its documents are and how to access and get to those. And I'm assuming Apple at the developer conference was sharing information with developers how they can build that functionality into their applications, into their APIs, so that they can tap into iCloud, they can tap into this new structure. The Finder itself is going to be with us for a little while longer, but I think it's going to become less and less relevant as applications change and they shift over to kind of this new model, this new way of thinking. But the Finder's still there, so you don't have to worry about it. You have that old reliable friend, but it is getting older. It's aging, and I think that's one of the things that Apple was pointing out here. The difference between Apple and how Apple is doing this and how others might be looking at sort of re-envisioning file management is the concept that Apple's always had. It's transparency. They're going to try and make the process seamless, and it's just going to work. So if you want to get an idea of what this might feel like, we've already seen it in a lot of applications. It started out with some of the Apple applications, things like iTunes, iPhoto, Aperture, even to some degree, things like iMovie, where you have all your video files just stored there within iMovie, or access to those right where you need them. You're putting together your video clips, you have the little tray over there, and that's where your video files are, the relevant files for working within that application. And I think we're going to see more and more of that metaphor. That's what we have on iOS. Each application kind of has that. But now they're going to decentralize the storage location or the place where that information is. And some of it is, a big part of that is going to be documents in the cloud, iCloud documents. Also, iCloud represents Apple leaving behind a lot of the services that we were used to and had with Mobile Me. Mobile Me, I think Steve Jobs made it obvious in the keynote that he was not happy with how Mobile Me came out, how it was deployed, and really wanted to re-envision that, and that's why we have iCloud. So services like iWeb, iDisk, Mobile Me Galleries, all that stuff's going to be going away. Galleries being replaced by the photo stream, iDisk being replaced by documents in the iCloud. It's unclear at this point what services will remain around, if there's going to be web interfaces for those services. It's seeming more and more like Apple's new model is to say applications are the way to go. Applications that access web services, that access this data in the cloud, but you're not going to have this browser interface like Google and some of the other services are. And there's debate going on right now whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. Apple has actually built some pretty nice web interfaces on top of MobileMe. If you go to me.com, accessing mail and calendars works really well. Doing your MobileMe galleries, accessing websites and stuff like that, that is very likely going away. I think Apple has a different vision, and I think they showed us that at WWDC. As far as when that's going to happen, if you're a current MobileMe customer, the cutoff date is June 30th, 2012, so you have about a year to prepare for it. Apple already has some documents available for developers that have been leaked that show the process of how you migrate and move some of this data, so they're going to work that out. I'm imagining that that's going to be a very seamless transition to move your current files and information from things like iDisk over to iCloud documents and stuff like that. But those details are just slowly emerging. We don't have a lot of information on that right now. The current web interfaces are going to cease to exist after that date. It has already been indicated through some leaks that iCloud already has a version of the iCal invite system, but it really seems to just be a single page. And I think that's significant because I think what's going to happen is that you're going to tap these services from applications. You might go to a web page like we do. A good example of this, I think, is music links. If you click an iTunes music link, yes, it launches Safari and it brings up that preview page in case you don't have the relevant application installed, in this case iTunes, to launch the iTunes store and take you to the actual app. But that's really just a placeholder. I think ultimately Apple is going to direct you to applications that then tap into the iCloud services and you access them that way. A lot of people are asking, why not both? Why can't we have both? Why is it sort of this one or another? And I think that is a valid argument. I think in Apple's case, they just see that on their devices, running applications provides a richer user experience than maybe they can build with the web. They kind of, when they launched iOS, started down that whole web application process, and you can do a lot of really great things with web apps, but I think they're really thinking of this as a client services type model. It's almost like we're going back to the early days of computing when we had network computers and all the computing was done on the network, and we had these kind of thin clients. In Apple's case, it looks like they're envisioning Macs and iOS devices as these clients. They're obviously not thin clients. They have a lot of power built into them. And that's why I think there's going to be this kind of combination of local storage, network storage, and cloud storage, kind of these three levels. But I think what Apple wants to do is make ultimately where that stuff is really transparent to the user. You're just going to open up your application. You're going to have access to your documents. You're not going to have to be really concerned about where they are. You'll be able to sync some things. Syncing was a big part of the iCloud initiative, and we're going to talk about that more in a minute. The other announcement that came out of WWDC that was a shocker to me, but falls in line with this concept of Apple kind of demoting the PC or the Mac, is that they announced for iOS, you're not going to need a PC anymore. They are going through their post-PC transition and saying, we are not going to be tethered or tied to a desktop or a notebook to actually operate some of these other devices like the iPhone, the iPod, and the iPad. And MacNN reported that possibly as many as 50% of current iPhone owners have never connected their iPhones to iTunes. I believe this data was gathered from surveying some of the geniuses at different Apple stores. And they say, yeah, people don't hook these devices up to computers. That means they're not getting backed up. They're not getting software updates, which, as we know now with the Mac Defender viruses and things like that out there, we're becoming more and more of a target for hackers and scammers and people writing malware. So it's going to be important for Apple to be able to update the operating system, to update applications, and they're not going to be able to rely on people having PCs anymore. There's a lot of people out there who an iPad can be their primary device, and they need the ability to cut the cord and to be able to sync that stuff up. And again, without having a lot of local storage on a device like that, you do need another solution. So Apple built this big data center, and they're giving us iCloud. And I think that's another significant reason why they made iCloud free. That's a big change from the Mobile Me model. And you're now going to be able to get all of these services, or at least a certain level of them, free. I think you get 5 gigabytes of storage along with a bunch of other services. And you'll be able to tap into that right out of the gate, directly from your iOS device. We've already seen some screenshots too. Apple built a really nice, simple setup process. When you first turn on your new iPad or iPhone running iOS 5, it's going to walk you through the process of getting an iCloud account, getting an Apple ID if you already don't have that, setting up your information, starting you through the process. And that is a big change from what we've seen in the past, and really addresses a complaint a lot of people had about iOS and iPads being the primary computing device that some people might want to use. And I think Apple recognizes that this is happening and this is the future. So we're kind of moving and putting all of these things on equal footing. iOS devices, smartphones, iPads are now kind of at equal level with the desktops and notebooks, and also with online services and storage. All of these things are coming together. When I had envisioned what Apple was going to announce at WWDC, I thought we were going to have a lot about the integration of iCloud and iOS and Mac. I guess I envisioned it more being APIs and stuff that were integrated into the operating system. And I know that stuff's probably going on behind the scenes, but really Apple gave us the broader encompassing vision of how all these things are going to come together and be equal partners and tiers in sort of this new online digital hub that they're building. The other big announcement and thing that was addressed that I thought was significant at WWDC was notifications on iOS devices. A lot of people have been complaining about notifications. In case you missed it, there are some new widgets. Apple built a built-in application. It's not like an app that you launch. It's just there in the background. You kind of swipe down from the top and you get this thing called Notification Center. And it has widgets. We had been hearing rumors that Apple was going to add widgets to iOS. There's now a built-in weather and stock widget along with your custom notifications or your notifications. And there was a developer in the UK that actually discovered a way. Apple hasn't announced an official API for widgets, but a way that he could hack in, and he built a little Hello World widget that drops into the Notification Center. So it's technically possible. There hasn't been word if Apple's going to make that available to third-party developers, but that could be a very interesting addition. But right off the bat, the Notification Center really looked like Android notifications, where you pull down from the top and then you have all your notifications there. But it really goes much further than that. I think it's a much cleaner implementation. Now that I have an Android device, I can kind of get an idea of how Android handles it. And you get all these little icons up at the top in Android in the menu bar, and it gets really cluttered very, very quickly. Apple doesn't do that. To see your notifications, you have to swipe that thing down, and then you have all of them there. But it goes even further because they give you more finite control over the notifications, which I think is great. You now have the ability to say which apps you want to give notifications in Notification Center and on the lock screen, how many items from each one would be displayed so you can go back and review. They have this really neat feature where you can swipe on any notification to directly launch to that application, even from the lock screen. So it'll take you right to that item within the relevant application. And those are the kinds of things that add a lot of convenience and a lot of functionality to something like notifications. So far from the early reviews we're hearing from developers, everybody's loving the new notification system, and I'm looking forward to getting my hands on that and playing around with it. So one of the questions that kind of came out of this is a lot of the functionality I think that we're seeing in Lion and iOS, it seems like iOS is moving up the chain. Steve Jobs said that thing. He said, "We are demoting the Mac. We're demoting the PC." And so that led to a lot of people asking, is iOS the future? And Piper Jaffray's Gene Munster did a poll of developers at WWDC, just 45, so it's not a really good sampling, but they asked the question to developers, what are you coding for? Are you coding for iOS? Are you coding for Mac? And they found that right now, developers who are coding for iOS, only 7% of them are writing Mac applications. And I guess they did a similar poll back in 2009, and at that time found that it was about 50-50. About half the developers developing for iOS were developing for the Mac. So that number has significantly changed. They also found that iOS developers, 47% of them developing for iOS are also developing for Android, and 36% for RIM. Only about 13% on Windows. And so it was interesting to see that really mobile, if you're a mobile developer, you're developing for the major mobile platforms. There wasn't much interest in WebOS or Symbian, which is the Nokia platform. But definitely developers developing for iOS are developing for other platforms. The thing about these numbers is I think it likely more shows that developers are now choosing their platform when it comes to Apple products. And again, I think it goes back to the significance of these devices are moving into an equal playing field, and one is maybe not more significant than the other. I think Piper Jaffray was trying to make the case that there's more money in developing iOS applications. I kind of disagree with that because I think the price points are lower, and I think it's harder to distinguish yourself on iOS than it would be on the Mac platform. I think developers are attracted by the ease of use of selling on the App Store, on the iOS App Store, which is a little bit more mature than the Mac App Store. But I think as the Mac App Store takes off, we're going to see developers on the Mac side really flocking to that and using that model to help promote and sell their products. But I think it's just developers saying, I'm going to develop for the Mac or I'm going to develop for iOS, and there's not a lot of crossover. But I think as Apple brings out more and more tools to make porting and transitioning applications back and forth, that we will see more developers doing applications on both platforms. And I think it really depends on the application. There's some applications that lend themselves to iOS much better than the desktop and vice versa. And then there's the ones that you want to have integration. You want to be able to move your documents back and forth. And again, iCloud is going to be a significant piece for developers to leverage to be able to get the file system access and to be able to get the documents to go back and forth. Right now, so far, it's been very kludgy. And all of this is going to take some time. Apple has just announced these tools. They've just announced these new services. So it's going to be some time before these numbers build back up. Apple's really re-envisioned the ecosystem. And I think that's a significant thing coming out of WWDC. And a lot of people are talking about it. And we're going to have to watch and see what Apple does with it. There was one item at the keynote that leading up to it was getting a lot of buzz, a lot of rumor buzz, and we didn't hear anything about, and that was Nuance and voice control. Nuance, makers of Dragon Naturally Speaking, they bought Max Speech a while back and have integrated those products, Max Speech Dictate, into their product lineup. And there were all these rumors that Apple and Nuance had reached some sort of relationship or agreement or were about to, and that there was going to be a lot of Nuance technology built into iOS 5. We didn't hear anything about that, but since the keynote, a pretty well-known hacker in the iOS community who goes by the name of Chronic on Twitter claims that he found some hidden iOS 5 preferences that show the Nuance technology. There's a mic on space key, which I'm assuming means you'll hit the space key to start recording, and some Nuance dictation settings in these preferences that he discovered. So all of the rumors and things that I've been reading have been saying that basically it just wasn't ready. Either the deals weren't done or the technology wasn't ready to demo at WWDC. And that stuff is coming, but it's going to need some more time to kind of bake and for Apple to work on it. And I think also that Apple really, they're going to do an event in September when iOS 5 is ready to ship and we potentially get a new iPhone. All the rumors are still pointing to iPhone 5 sometime in September, probably at Apple's what traditionally would be their iPod event or their music event. I think we're going to hear a lot more about some of the iTunes cloud services and stuff like that. And that's going to be a big deal. And Apple wants to show off some things with iOS 5 there. And I think that's when we'll hear about a release date, possibly even right at that event. We'll be able to download iOS 5 and Apple will announce a launch date for the new hardware. So looking forward to that. But that was kind of my initial thoughts and impressions coming out of WWDC. Obviously, there's going to be a lot more for us to talk about in the coming weeks and months and stuff like that as we get more and more details. But right off the top of my head, that's what I've been thinking about. And later on in the show, I'm going to cover some of the features that weren't announced at WWDC that have been being leaked and discovered by different developers and stuff like that, and maybe that you either have or haven't heard about yet. And while we are, according to Apple, entering this post-PC era, and I think it's really, I have to comment on that, it's really confusing that Apple's using the term PC, PC-free and post-PC. I guess they've decided that the word Mac, and maybe this goes back to that whole equal footing, all these devices kind of being on a level playing field concept, and the dropping of Mac from, you know, Mac OS X Lion, it just being OS X Lion, that the generic term PC is the thing that they're going to roll with moving forward. So when I'm saying PC now, I'm not talking about a Windows desktop. I'm talking about personal computer, the truest sense of the form. But, you know, in this post-PC era, I think the Mac is not out of the running yet. And Gene Munster and IDC came out with some of their Mac sales predictions for the current quarter. Mac sales in the first 2 months of the quarter, May and April, they've estimated are up about 15%. Wall Street was looking for a year-over-year growth of about 22% for Apple's third quarter, which actually ends this month. So they're a little under the current Wall Street estimates, but the report did say that Apple's had very strong MacBook Air sales, which is not surprising considering the rave reviews the MacBook Air is getting and just how many people really love those new MacBook Airs, the 13-inch and the 11-inch. They're up 38% year-over-year. MacBook sales are up 35% year-over-year, and that's what's been driving the quarter so far. But we've been getting rumors that Apple's getting to rev some of those products. They also just released the Sandy Bridge Thunderbolt iMac, so that should help the June numbers. And so they could still reach that 22% year-over-year growth target. There have been rumors of a Sandy Bridge MacBook Air refresh coming soon. It could be a late pump to the end of the quarter numbers. Apple has reportedly ordered 380,000 units, new MacBook Air units, to be shipped. So I would imagine we're going to see Thunderbolt ports on those new MacBook Airs, and we might have an announcement of that sometime soon. I don't think it'll be a big announcement. I think it'll be something that Apple will just kind of refresh out on the website, probably on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, which seems to be when they do those things. So maybe that'll happen in the next week or two. Also, there's been rumors of a possible Mac Mini refresh, Mac Mini server refresh, and maybe even a Mac Pro server refresh. Best Buy was reporting longer lead times of 1 to 2 weeks on the Mac Minis, which was what was kind of prompting this rumor, although Apple's site, last time I checked, was still showing a 24-hour ship time, so it wasn't quite jiving up. The other product that we're starting to hear rumors of a possible refresh for are airport base stations and time capsules. Apple Australia was showing longer lead times on those products, and some sources are reporting that Apple may be adding A5 processors and an iOS operating system to the airport or the time capsule. I kind of think it makes more sense for the time capsule, again, going in line with this concept of, I'm hoping Apple is thinking about what I would call a local iCloud, a network storage device. It's something that I've always wanted, is sort of the digital home hub for media, for documents, that is based on Apple technology and kind of seamlessly integrates with my iOS devices and my desktop operating system. In this case, I would assume Lion. So Lion is dropping the airport branding from a lot of their network settings and areas, so that seems to be indicating that Apple is thinking of the airport more as a device and not a technology that's built into the operating system. They're using the more generic term Wi-Fi, which is what Apple's been using in iOS for a while now. I think they are going to stick with the airport branding on the hardware and within the airport utility for actually configuring things, but that's more about configuring the hardware. Generically within the operating system, the Wi-Fi is going to be the term that Apple's going to go with. And a lot of people are thinking that's because airport to new users or users switching over can be a bit confusing. You know, Wi-Fi is the term that they're used to. I connect to my Wi-Fi network, and it doesn't matter if I have a Linksys or an Apple Airport or a D-Link or whatever it is. That's the Wi-Fi router. Apple also did just release a new version of the airport utility, which is further prompting the rumors that there might be a refresh of the airport or the time capsule. This came out on Wednesday, today as I record this. Apple says it resolves an issue that could have caused the airport utility to unexpectedly quit, but Mac Rumors has found some references to potential new Airport Extreme and Time Capsule hardware that could store software updates actually on the device. And I think that goes back to this concept of Apple moving to PC-free, and maybe when you walk into an Apple store, you're not walking out with a Mac and an airport base station. You're walking out with an iPad and an airport base station. You need to be able to configure that stuff. We've already seen that iOS 5 has the ability to configure, has the ability to configure airport base stations. It has an airport utility built into it. So that goes back to this whole concept of PC-free. And I'm really thinking that a time capsule with the built-in storage, the ability to access that and configure it from your iOS devices could be a really powerful thing. And then if Apple is hoping to jumpstart their sales with their back-to-school promotion, I don't know if they're going to cut it this year. Historically, in the past, Apple for back-to-school has given away free iPods with a new Mac purchase. This time around, we're getting $100 iTunes gift cards, and I don't know if that's going to be a compelling enough driver to get people into the Apple retail store to buy a new Mac, but new Sandy Bridge processors and Thunderbolt ports certainly would be, so maybe they're hoping that the hardware and the technology upgrades are going to be a significant enough push to get people in to buy new Macs for back to school, and the $100 iTunes gift card is just going to be a bonus. But I think Apple will make the Wall Street estimates of 22% year-over-year growth. That would be actually be down from some of the numbers they've been posting in past quarters recently. So still growing ahead of the PC industry, though, for sure, which is actually losing sales. I think predictions are currently around down 9% in the next quarter for the PC industry as a whole, and a lot of that being attributed to iOS and iPads and tablet devices, not just from Apple, but some of the other tablet devices like the Zoom tablet and stuff like that that people are flocking to. There was a little hiccup this week with Verizon iPads, a small recall. It was sort of quietly done by Apple, and they did ultimately confirm it. We started hearing early reports that Apple was holding back shipments of Verizon iPad 2s. Nobody really knew how many or why Apple was doing it, but it was confirmed. The affected units reportedly had been flashed with duplicate mobile equipment identifiers, MEID numbers. Those are the unique ID numbers. They need to be unique on each unit to be able to get it to connect to the cellular network. And so I guess some of the new iPads that were being purchased that had these duplicate numbers were having connectivity issues. So Apple did a small recall and started replacing the affected units. I don't think it's a huge issue, but if you bought a new Verizon iPad 2 recently and have been having troubles with it, you might want to contact Apple and just make sure you don't have one of those affected units, and they'll just swap it out for you, replace it. Should be a pretty easy process. As far as the iPad 3 goes, we are still this week getting rumors of iPad 3s waiting in the wings. I don't put a lot of stock in this. This week certainly saw a resurgence of the rumor that the next generation iPad is going to have a Retina display, at least a 2x resolution. One site got really crazy and said it was going to be a 5 to 6 times resolution increase, which is just, I mean, crazy. That's like 6,000 pixels. Apple is not going to do that. That's going to be too tricky for developers to deal with. But I do think that the next generation iPad will probably have a 2x resolution display increase. And that seems to be confirmed by some of the things that we're seeing in some of the image assets that are in the new iOS 5 beta. Somebody found some Twitter graphics that are the double-sized resolution, and we've already seen in the past, I think in iOS 4.3 builds, some double-resolution image files. That's 2048 by 1536, which is the doubling of the 1024 by 768 resolution, excuse me. And it's also believed that the next generation iPad would have a single world dual mode baseband chip to cover all frequencies for both the GSM and CDMA networks globally. That's the Qualcomm Gobi baseband chips. They're actually using those chips in the Verizon iPad 2s and the iPhone 4s, but those devices don't have a SIM slot, so they can't be used on the GSM networks currently. But the assumption would be Apple would use that chip or some sort of similar chip to allow them to sell a single 3G version of the iPad that could be used with all the different carriers all over. And that just makes sense. I mean, that's a logical thing for Apple to do, and I think that we will see that in the next generation device. What I don't think that we're going to see is some of the rumor websites are saying we're going to see an iPad 3 at that event in September. I really don't think that there is any incentive, and I don't have any evidence for this. It's just my gut instinct and you know, me watching Apple for as long as I have been to know that if sales are good and sales of the iPad 2 are really good right now, there isn't any reason to bring out a new device, potentially raise their build cost, because the longer they can keep a current product in channel and in production, their production costs go down. Component costs get cheaper. New double resolution displays are going to be, that's going to be a very expensive component. And historically, Apple doesn't raise prices. They keep prices the same. So that cuts into their margin. So I think they're going to continue to sell iPad 2s in their current form, at least through the end of the year. I think we'll see about a yearly release cycle on the iPad. And I don't see any compelling reason for Apple to change that. But the rumor sites seem to think that iPad 3 in September, and I know a lot of you often ask me, should I wait? If you're really concerned about it, you know, again, I don't have hard evidence on this. It's just gut feeling. If you're really concerned about it, wait till after September to find out. But if you were hoping to have a new iPad for the summer, you're going to have to be holding off. And I think if you want a new device or if you have a need for an iPad, you should get one now. The iPad 2 is a really great product. I absolutely love mine. And it's going to get a whole new life with iOS 5 when it's released. There's a lot of great new features that are in there. We're going to talk about some of those in a minute. And I think you wouldn't go wrong to have a new iPad 2 if you've been in the market for an iPad. It's funny how sometimes rumors come out and they get resolved very, very quickly. A rumor came out, I think on Monday or Tuesday, that Apple was going to release an unlocked version of the iPhone in the U.S. It was confirmed Tuesday morning when Apple actually started selling the device, Apple and AT&T. For $649, you can now get a 16-gigabyte iPhone 4 or a 32-gigabyte iPhone 4 for $749. Right now, it's only the GSM version, so only the AT&T version, but you can get it completely unlocked. That would technically allow you in the U.S. to use your iPhone on T-Mobile. You could go get your T-Mobile SIM and pop it in the unlocked iPhone 4, which would be awesome for a lot of customers, except for the fact that the current generation chip that's in the iPhone 4 doesn't support T-Mobile's 3G frequency. So you're going to be relegated to only using their Edge network. So it'd be like a huge step backwards. So even though you can get an unlocked device in the U.S., for the typical U.S. customer, there's not a big compelling reason. Also, on T-Mobile, you're not going to be able to get access to things like visual voicemail, which is one of the great features in iOS. So really, I think Apple is putting out the unlocked iPhone 4s for people who might be traveling internationally, anybody who maybe doesn't want to be locked into a contract on AT&T. Although before you could get the locked AT&T phone without a contract just by paying full price for the device, I'm pretty sure that you could. I didn't know too many people that did that because it was just expensive, and why not get a subsidized one if you're going to have to get service anyway? But details are still spotty on whether or not AT&T is going to support pay-as-you-go plans with the new unlocked phones. But if you go internationally, you are going to be able to take that unlocked device, get a local SIM, get local cellular and data service when you're traveling, when you're in a different country. So that is going to be useful for a certain kind of customer. And it's nice that we now have that option in the U.S. As far as if you want to stay in the U.S. and you want to get that unlocked phone, you don't want to have your contract, you can still get the standard plans that AT&T offers. It's $40 a month for the voice, and then the two data plans that they offer, 250 megabytes of data a month for $15 a month, or you can get the plan that is $25 a month, and I think you get 2 gigabytes of data. On pay-as-you-go, they do have a plan that for $25, you can get 500 megabytes of data a month, and that goes for 30 days. But at that point, I don't know why you just wouldn't, because you're not going to be on contract and you could still cancel at any time, why you wouldn't just go with the voice plus data service under the standard plans. But there may be some additional details if AT&T does officially announce that they're going to support pay-as-you-go. I think there's some ways to actually get on pay-as-you-go with just an unlocked iPhone, but it's a little bit tricky to do, and I don't know that it's all that consumer-friendly. But you do need to use a micro SIM card. That's the other thing I wanted to mention. So if you are going to get an unlocked phone and you're going to be traveling internationally, make sure before you go, you check, make sure which carriers offer micro SIMs, or you might need to buy a SIM cutter, which that could be a costly way to go. But I guess if you really need it, you can cut down a full-size SIM and get it to fit into an unlocked iPhone. I think that SIM cutter is a pretty large device, so if you're going to be traveling with it, you could have some problems getting through security, so you might want to put that in your checked luggage if you're going to be doing that. But good news if you've been waiting for that to happen in the U.S. If you're a Final Cut Pro user and you've been waiting and waiting for Apple's newest update, which they actually showed off back in April at NAB, at the National Association of Broadcasters event, Final Cut Pro 10 is on its way. Apple didn't give a release date, specific release date, but they did announce pricing, $299 price point. There's no Express version. They just dropped the price of the full version of Final Cut Pro. They showed off a bunch of killer new features. A lot of people are very excited about it, but everybody's been wondering when we're actually going to get to see it. Well, a Japanese Mac blog this week reported that Final Cut Pro 10 would be available on the App Store next week. I don't know the reliability of this rumor, but there were also some new screenshots that were leaked that Apple promptly sent out. All right, I'm not sure if it was exactly Apple, but also a third party had sent out some cease and desist letters, so those images were pulled down. And typically when that happens, that means that the images are, one, confirmed to be legitimate, which is kind of funny. Just by doing the cease and desist, Apple almost confirms the leak. But then also that there are some new features, some late-stage features that are completed and we can expect in the next version of the product. So whether or not that means we'll see Final Cut Pro 10 released next week remains to be seen, but for those of you who have been waiting, that might be some exciting news, and look for it on the App Store, hopefully soon. And then the last thing I had for you in the news for this week, there was an update to iBooks amongst all the WWDC stuff. Apple did release a new version of iBooks. The update includes a feature that is called Read Aloud. It's really designed, I think, for children's books, and it allows the book to have a narration, basically an audio book that can be read to you. And in some books, the words will actually even highlight as the person's reading along. So that could help with reading development and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool. Also, more improvements to the enhanced books. They can now automatically play audio and video from within the book. And the update also addresses some performance issues, especially when opening very long books, so they're a little bit more responsive, and addressed an issue where some books might have been displaying the same page twice. So if you thought you were having a little bit of deja vu the last time you were reading an iBook, you probably want to grab this update and try that again. It's not you. There actually was a bug. So there you have it. That's the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, if you're looking for a note-taking application, I highly recommend taking a look at Circus Ponies Notebook because, one, It's great for taking notes. It has all kinds of great features for doing outlines, for taking general notes, for dropping in additional information, supporting documents, images, and stuff like that. It makes it all very easy. It also makes it very easy to organize that stuff into different sections. You can add tabs. You can add sticky notes and flags. Essentially, everything that you could do in a traditional notebook, you can do in Circus Pony's notebook. And they have great built-in drawing tools. But one thing that really attracts me to applications is just the user interface and the beauty of it. And that's the other thing about notebook is you can pick all kinds of different papers. If you want graph paper, if you want college ruled yellow line paper, if you want standard line paper, if you want blank pages, all that's built in. You can do a three ring binder, perfect binding. They have all these great options to really flesh out the metaphor. They've really thought about how things look, and that just makes, to me, the applications more enjoyable to use. So on top of all the great features and functionality that's built in there, and the list goes on and on, you can go to the website, you can watch, they have some great how-to tutorial videos that were done by Don McAllister from Screencasts Online. You can see all the great features that are in there. Indexing is another one. You know, how often have you put something into a note-taking application and then you can't find that thing? The ability to organize into sections, but not only that, to have an index that's automatically created and indexed in multiple ways, so everybody thinks a little bit differently. Maybe you're just looking for a URL that you know you put into your notes somewhere. Well, they automatically separate out all the URLs or capitalized words, or the list goes on and on. So you can check it all out. Check out all the great features. You can also get a free trial, so if you'd like to try the application before you buy it, you can do that, and they have full information and details over at circusponies.com. I know you're going to love the application. And I've said it before, it's one of those apps that once you get it for, say you thought you were just going to get it for taking notes, you suddenly find that you're making your travel plans with it. Because guess what? I can drop in my order receipts and my confirmation tickets as PDFs and put them right in line there with my itinerary. And I can organize all that stuff. And it works out really beautifully. So check it out, circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On the past few shows, we've had a whole series of Find My iPhone tips, or Find My, I don't know what to call this thing anymore, because starting in Lion, you're going to have Find My Mac, and Find My iPod, and Find My iPhone. Apple needs to come up with a better name. It's just like Find My device. Find My, I don't want to say Find My thing, because that sounds dirty. But it's Find My, the whole series of Find My tips and alternate uses. So you don't have to use it just to recover your lost or stolen device. There's some other creative uses that people are finding for that application. And since Apple's made it free, anybody with an iOS device or a Mac can now sign up and get it. And we continue that trend this week with another tip from Jared.
Hey, Adam, it's Jared from up in Monterey. I was just listening to the MacCast episode from May 29th and wanted to share a little tip with using Find My iPhone. I'm not sure how many folks out there know this, but there's a great little way if you want to use Find My iPhone, say if you've got a teenager and you want to keep tabs on your teenager. You can turn on Find My iPhone in the phone, and then you can go into Settings, and then General and Restrictions. You can create a passcode, and then turn off the ability for somebody to access or disable location services. This is a great way if you've got devious teenagers or others who may try to get into the phone and disable that feature. This will keep them from being able to do that. Anyway, hope you enjoy the tip. Love the show, and please keep up the good work. Take care, Adam.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is I think if you're going to do that, tell your teenager that you're doing it. You don't want to degrade any trust issues. I guess it probably depends on the actual teenager in your particular situation, but I think you want to be pretty transparent about that stuff. We don't need to set up our own, at-home location gate scandal. They're going to be pretty upset if they find out you're secretly trying to track them, either a teenager or whatever person in your life. But it can be a safety thing. I mean, if it could be something you could just talk about asking them to turn on, because you'd have the ability to know where they were, and if there was a problem, something happened, you'd be able to track them down just simply for safety reasons. That's what I would really argue. So yeah, I say it's definitely a good thing to use for that purpose. If you have somebody who's maybe going out for a hike or a jog or something like that on their own, and they're going to be in a more remote area, be good to have location services on, have Find My iPhone turned on in case something were to happen. It just makes good sense. And internally within a family, there's no reason not to do that, because you still have that privacy in place. The one thing I will note on the restrictions is that you can bypass the restrictions by doing a restore on the iPhone and not restoring from backup. So if that person has the ability to restore the device, they could potentially just wipe away everything and start from scratch. Again, you're not going to be able to get your data and your apps and stuff back on there from your backup. You're going to have to manually reinstall those. But a devious teenager, as you put it, or just one who has a little technical savvy, is probably going to be able to figure out how to get past that. So you're better off doing the upfront route, saying, look, I want this on so that I can keep track of you and keep you safe, and go the trust route. I think that's always a better way to go. But thanks for the tip, Jared, and definitely is a good use of Find My iPhone. So as promised, I want to dive back into WWDC for a little bit, maybe talk about some of the things that weren't announced in the keynote, things that have come out since then on the blogs, and some cool features and stuff that you might have missed. Just my general impressions that it was long. I think it ended up being about 2 hours, almost 2 hours. Apple had a lot of things to cover, very impressive in terms of the announcements. Lion looks like it's shaping up to be a really nice update. I particularly like the updates to Mission Control, which is like Expose on steroids. Apple's kind of combining all of your window management and Expose features, spaces and stuff like that, coming together really in a nice cohesive way under Mission Control, all controlled with some really cool gestures. So if you have a trackpad, a Magic Trackpad, or a MacBook Pro, you're going to be able to really take advantage of a lot of those things. One feature that I think, as developers implement it within their applications, Apple is putting it into their built-in applications and Pages and iWork and stuff like that, is the resume, autosave, and version features. Actually, three features that kind of come together. And I think these are what I'm going to call the sleeper features of Lion, because I think it's going to be that feature that's there. It's running in the background. You don't really notice it until you actually go to use it. So things like quitting an application, you have open documents, you have palettes and things in certain places where you really like them, and if the app doesn't have a built-in way for you to save that information, currently, you reopen that application, you've got to start over. You've got to reopen your document, you've got to reposition all your palettes and stuff like that, get them back the way you like them. With Resume, built into all of the applications under Lion, you're going to be able to just open that application and boom, have everything back where it was. Autosave is another one of those things. No more having to, we're going to have to undo that training of Command-S for saving all the time. It's just going to happen automatically for applications that support it. And again, developers are going to have to support these new features, but Apple's made the APIs and stuff available. They made it really easy for them to leverage this stuff. And then versions, that's like time machines for applications, for documents. So you'll be able to go back, get different versions. If you made that text change, or even two or three generations down the road, you made a bunch of text changes and you decide, you know what, I want to go back. I want to go back to that original version. Not all applications support multiple undos. Well, now with versions, you'll be able to just jump back in time, and you can even grab bits and pieces and bring those forward. It's really neat how Apple's done it, because it actually just saves the differences, so it's not going to take up a lot of space, especially if you're just talking about text documents or page layout documents and stuff like that. And I think a lot of people are going to really appreciate those three features together. And if it's implemented as seamlessly as Apple kind of showed off in their demo, again, it's going to be that sleeper feature, that thing in the background that everybody's going to love. AirDrop is another interesting one for sharing files on a local area network. I think this is going to be especially useful for small work groups and multiple Mac families where you need to share documents with each other. You just be able to drop that right onto anybody who's in your Bonjour network and automatically send it to them. And I love the little AirDrop icon, the little crate with the parachute. That was my favorite icon of the demo. And then lots of really great updates to Mail. It's becoming more like iOS. I personally like iOS's presentation of mail. I think it works really well for me and how I just go through my emails. Some people are maybe not liking it as much, but I think the killer feature that I'm going to really enjoy with Lion's mail is the conversations, kind of taking email threading to the next level and keeping everything together. The one thing I always struggle with is getting, you know, my part of that conversation, the replies to emails. You kind of have to search through that stuff. I have some tricks that I do with Spotlight and, you know, using the different filters and stuff like that, and conversations is going to solve a lot of that for me. So I think that's going to really make my emailing much more enjoyable. Looking forward to seeing Lion. It's going to come out in July, $29 upgrade through the App Store. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the challenges that brings here in a second. But I wanted to talk about my impressions on just some of the iOS 5 features that Apple announced. It really, I think iOS 5, the all-encompassing thing I came out of with the keynote was that it really addressed a lot of the complaints that competitors have had. A lot of people who prefer Android devices, Apple addressed a lot of those issues. Michael Johnston on the We Have Communicators podcast this week, when we talked, put it this way. He said, you know, I have fewer and fewer, he's a jailbreaker, I have fewer and fewer reasons to jailbreak my iPhone every time Apple releases a new update. And I think the big one there is Notification Center. It's really going to change things for a lot of people. Another huge feature is iMessage, being able to get off of your SMS messaging plan. I think Apple really caught the carriers off guard on that one. It's going to be interesting to see if that puts some strain on Apple's relationship with AT&T and Verizon, because they are going to lose some revenue to iMessage. If you have iOS devices, it seamlessly switches over your SMS to the iMessage platform, which means it's going to be free, and you're going to be able to get iPod touches that have now messaging and group messaging, and I'm really excited to start playing around with iMessage. iReminders is another thing. It's a neat little built-in to-do application. The kind of killer feature that Apple was highlighting was the fact that you can set up a reminder that's location aware. I think part of this is Apple's way of getting us to opt into their location services and into sharing our location, because if you have that turned on, iReminders, you can set up reminders that have, I think Apple called it a location fence or perimeter, and when you leave that area, the reminder will pop up. So say you have a grocery store that you always go to and you need to remember to get milk. You can set the location for that as the grocery store, and as you're leaving the grocery store, you can have a reminder pop up that says, did you remember the milk? Did you remember to buy milk? And so you won't forget to buy milk. I think that's really cool, and I'm surprised that I don't know of a third-party application that has that kind of feature. Maybe there is one out there, but Apple implemented that. I find it interesting that Apple did basically what amounts to a to-do list application. They've had to-dos built into Calendar, built into Mail. Now we have a third application for that. Apple has this history of kind of adding, for as much as they add simplicity in a lot of areas, they also sometimes add complexity. So I guess they're maybe extracting to-do lists out of, they're recognizing that people don't want that as part of or integrated into other applications. I guess some people do, but Apple's historically taken this more individual app, simple app approach. But there's also all those great third-party to-do list applications, so I don't know how that fits into the ecosystem. It'll be interesting to see if I use iReminders or if I stick with something like Things, or I'm currently kind of back on an OmniFocus kick, and I've been using that as kind of my GTD to-do list application. But iReminders does look like a nice implementation. A lot of people have emailed me to say they're very excited about the camera and photo upgrades. You can now access the camera directly from the lock screen. You can also use the volume up button on the iPhone as a physical button. Remember, Apple caused quite a scandal because the developers of Camera Plus tried to do that in their application and they got banned from the App Store. So Apple borrowed that idea, I guess. Maybe they always had plans to do it, but you know, it looks like another situation where Apple is kind of not allowing a third-party developer to do something and then implementing it themselves. There's been a couple of those things in the iOS 5 update. The Wi-Fi syncing is another one of those that's been called into question. There was a developer who had put out an application for Wi-Fi syncing on the App Store. His icon even looks very similar to the icon that Apple showed in their keynote, and it's caused a little bit of a kerfuffle in the Mac community recently. But he was banned. He made a lot of money on Cydia through jailbreak. So I don't know how upset he is, a little bit at least, because he did a blog post. But Apple does borrow quite frequently from others. I think they have a good history of that, despite a lot of people saying that a lot of people copy from Apple. Jobs has always had that famous quote that says, good artists copy, great artists steal. And I think they obviously live by that mantra. But you can press the physical button to snap a picture. And I'm most excited about some of the upgrades to the photo application, because I'm constantly wanting to just do a simple crop or a simple rotate of a photo, and to not have that built in has been infuriating to me. To have to go to a third-party app for that, for just that little bit of functionality, was always crazy. So it's nice that Apple's built that in. There's also the auto enhance feature for just kind of cleaning up the camera stuff, adjusting maybe a color shift if you have bad lighting, something like that. And that's going to be a really welcome feature for a lot of people. The enhance and editing features do require an A4 or an A5 processor that came out this week. So if you have an iPhone 3GS, that is one feature that you're not going to get access to. But a lot of the other features that were announced are still available on the older devices. And so that was nice to see. Safari's getting a nice upgrade with tabbed browsing. A lot of people were rejoicing with that, not to have to do that thing where you have multiple pages that are kind of in the background. It's much easier for switching between different web pages that you might be looking at to have a tabbed interface. I'm glad that Apple decided to concede that battle and go back to tabbed browsing on iOS devices. They added Reader and Reading List. Reader has been there on the Mac version of Safari. I haven't really used it too much. And then Reading List looks to be sort of a competitor to Instapaper. I'm not really sure that I will want to use Apple's built-in stuff. It's going to sync through iCloud and stuff like that, which could be really nice, but I've typically stuck with the third-party applications that I've ended up with in the past when Apple's added these features, most specifically in RSS. Apple added RSS to Safari, but I still prefer a third-party RSS reader. I think it handles it better. Apple's features tend to be more simplified. So I guess if you have light needs, but I rely very heavily on readability, Instapaper, and those types of technologies. So I'll have to get back to you on whether or not Reading List does enough for me and can replace Instapaper or not, but I don't think it will. PC Free. That was the big thing. And again, PC meaning personal computer, not Windows. The ability to sync and manage and work with iOS devices without the need of ever hooking them up to a computer. So we can now set them up, we can sync them over Wi-Fi, we can update the software over the air, and that is huge. That is a big change from Apple's prior positioning on iOS, and I think it makes, as I was mentioning earlier, a significant step forward in terms of what the future of Apple and their products and stuff are going to be. And then I just have to say one other thing, AirPlay mirroring, in case you missed that, that just justified even more so my upgrading my original Apple TV to an Apple TV 2. The ability to just hit a button on my iPad and mirror the screen wirelessly to a television, to a projector. It's going to be great for doing presentations. I do a lot of presenting at my local Mac user group, so I'll be able to just bring my Apple TV down, hook that right into the projector, and not be wired and remotely give a presentation on something on the iPad. I'm really looking forward to playing around with that feature. And I've told you before, I'm just in love with AirPlay. I think it's a great technology. I'm using it for video. I'm using it for audio. I'm going to be using it for the mirroring stuff. Apple just keeps leveraging that technology, and I think it's going to be very, very powerful. And when they open the APIs to developers and let them start doing some things with that, it's just going to get better and better. I talked to somebody today who has one of the new receivers that's plugged in that supports AirPlay. I think it's a Denon receiver, and it can display track information on the TV when it's integrated with his home theater system, and he's just loving that. And it just works. It is one of those technologies that you just, you press the AirPlay button, you select where you want to send that video or audio to, and it just works. And I love that. It's absolutely awesome. iCloud, you know, iCloud, iTunes Match service, really, the iPhone is just a device. Steve Jobs said, we're moving the digital hub to the cloud. And so you can think of your Mac, iTunes, iPhoto, those aren't going to be the center anymore. Apple's going to make it iCloud. I think it's going to be a slow transition. It's going to take a while for all of us to get used to that new metaphor, but that is definitely the direction Apple's moving. I do have to say, in looking at document management, the one thing that I'm concerned about, I'm a big Dropbox user. I really like the idea of Dropbox, where I put something locally on my Mac and then it moves into the cloud. It's there, and then I can access it from my iOS device and pull it down. iCloud is a little bit different. Everything seems to be based around this concept of syncing. Yes, with the documents stuff, you're going to put copies up into the iCloud, but then they're also automatically pushed down to your devices. Steve Jobs stressed that point a couple different times, both with the photo syncing and with the document syncing. And I'm not so sure that I always want my documents synced up or copies, multiple copies on my iPhone, my iMac, or my Mac and my iPad, because I have limited storage. I'm already running out of space. I'm out of space on my MacBook Pro. I'm dealing with that this week. I got to get a bigger hard drive. That's the solution there. But you can't get more storage on your iPad. I have a 32 gigabyte iPad and it's completely full. I've had to delete off some content to get more apps on or to put that new movie that I just downloaded on. And that management is getting to be difficult. So I want some stuff to be able to just live in the cloud and pull it down. The one thing that's worked out really great for me is the new iCloud iTunes stuff, the ability to pull down music that I've purchased previously that's not on my iPad on demand. I'm really liking that new feature, and I think I'm going to like the iTunes Match service for that reason, to be able to sort of unlock access to media that I have on my iTunes, on my Mac, and then selectively pull that down when I want. You know, if I hadn't synced over that one track, I can go, oh, I can go grab that. I can just grab that now. And I think another problem with the iCloud metaphor, at least initially with specifically iOS devices, is going to be data. We don't have unlimited data anymore with the cellular networks, the 3G networks, and it gets worse outside the U.S. We have pretty, if you look at the grand scheme of things compared to most countries, we have pretty liberal data caps. There's some countries that have very, very restrictive data caps, and it's going to be very hard to be auto-syncing and automatically pulling down stuff through the cloud. So I do have some concerns there. I like this whole concept of losing the file system metaphor. I think it's great that my applications are going to be aware of the documents that they can interact with and it can go out and find them. I'm just hoping it can find them not only through the internet, but locally as well. And even more so, as I mentioned earlier, if I can set up a local cloud, this concept of maybe a time capsule that has centralized data for all my Macs, for all my iOS devices, and just access that when I'm at home on my Wi-Fi network, I think that could prove to be very, very powerful. iTunes Match, in case you missed that, that's the service that Apple is going to allow you for $25 a year, which is just awesome pricing, by the way. I thought it was going to be at least, you know, $5-$10 a month. But for $25 a year, they'll scan your iTunes library. Anything, whether you bought it through the iTunes store or whether you ripped it yourself, as long as it's in the iTunes catalog, and Apple, I forget how many millions of songs they have now, but they have a huge catalog. I think Steve Jobs said it's very likely we're going to have a copy of that. You'll automatically have access to that, and if Apple has a higher quality version, I have a lot of stuff that I ripped myself back in the day that's very low quality MP3. I'll now be able to re-download that from iTunes in an iTunes AAC 256 kilobit iTunes Plus format and pull that down. But again, not streaming. A lot of people were hoping for a streaming service. This is not a streaming service. You will be downloading that content and putting it back onto your devices. So that's a big difference between, I think, what Google and some of the other services are doing. And it uses an app, not a web interface, which, again, is Apple's overreaching metaphor for all this. They think the app is the way to access this data and not just a web interface. So I guess I'm going to make up a little bit in this episode for being out last week. We're going to do an extra long one because I still have a lot of stuff to get to. I want to talk about some of the features that came out or that weren't announced at WWDC that you might have missed that have come out since the announcement. Steve Jobs showed off 10 features within each one of the areas, but there are really some other good ones that you might have missed. iMessage, one thing about that is that there is auto-switching from SMS to iMessage. I don't think that was made really clear. It was probably covered in the keynote, but I want to stress the point because I think this is really significant for anybody who uses iOS devices. If you have friends and family members who are using iOS devices, once you've registered your Apple ID with the iMessage service and the phone numbers, if someone sends you a text message and then it recognizes that they are also an iMessage user, it will automatically switch over to that and allow you to start using iMessage, meaning that that's not going to go against your SMS or your MMS messaging charges. So you're going to be able to save some money on that. Also, it gives you true group messaging so that when you're doing a group message, unlike the SMS now, you can send out a group message, but when everybody replies, you just get the one reply from each person. And not everybody in the group is getting the reply, just you are getting those replies. So now in iMessage, everybody's going to get the replies and be able to see all of them. You can assign a phone number and multiple email addresses to an iMessage account. So just like with FaceTime, if you have more than one email address that you want people to find you at, you can plug all of those in, and that way it will be able to find that email and use iMessage. So this is great. I have different emails that I give out to different groups of people. I'll be able to get them all under the iMessage umbrella. Again, if they're using iOS devices, you have to be on an iOS device to use iMessage. Otherwise, it'll just default back to SMS. So that's that seamlessness that I think is going to be really the thing that people really like about iMessage, and that and on top of saving some money. And you do have the option to force it to use SMS instead of iMessage if you don't want to use that feature, but I don't know why you wouldn't want to use iMessage. Accessibility is something that really wasn't covered, and there's a lot of great new accessibility features in there. And some of these accessibility features, I think people who don't require accessibility options are really going to be able to take advantage of and really like. One of them is custom vibration patterns. These are kind of like ringtones, like custom ringtones, but for your vibration alerts. And it's really neat the way that you add them. You actually tap out custom patterns. Apple has a little interface and you tap and you kind of get a little ripple effect going, and you can tap out your own custom patterns. So I have a feeling there might even crop up a whole community if there's some way of actually sharing these things. I think it would be really cool so people can tap out custom patterns and share them. I think Apple's going to have a tone store for different alert tones that you'll be able to download and install and assign to things. I don't know if they'll include custom vibration patterns with that, but that could be a cool thing. LED flash alerts, so you'll be able to set up different flashing alerts on the LED. So if you have your phone in silent mode and it's across the room and you get a new text message, the LED flash can flash at you so that you know. Assistive touch is something that will allow you to assign customized gestures that will execute macros like shortcuts. I guess this is in early development. You can kind of assign them, but I don't think they really do much now, but that is going to be a very powerful feature for a lot of people. Text to speech and speaking selections. So for visually impaired users, that's going to be really helpful and powerful. And so it's great to see Apple continuing to expand the accessibility features. We've had Josh DeLionCourt from the Mac Accessibility podcast on the show before, and if you've missed those episodes, you should go back and listen. We should probably have him back on to cover some of these new features, but it's really, he said that the iPhone and the iOS devices are really devices that are enabling people who need accessibility options to use these new smartphone devices, and often they've been left out of having the latest and greatest technology. And it's great that Apple is allowing these features to be there and for those users to be able to take advantage of this technology. I never thought that a touch interface phone would be ideal for a visually impaired person, but it is, because Apple is making it that way. FaceTime is going to be able to be used over 3G. That's built into iOS 5. A lot of people have been waiting for that to come out. The rub there is that it's going to be carrier dependent, and it's looking right now like Verizon is not going to support 3G, or at least these are the rumors, not going to be able to support 3G over 3G FaceTime at launch. No word on whether or not AT&T will allow it, but at least from a built-in standpoint, iOS is going to support FaceTime over 3G. The iPhone, I already told you about the ability to use the volume button to snap a picture, but what's cool about that is you can also use the headphones, the Apple earbuds that have the little inline remote, to do the same thing. So you can press volume up on the inline remote when it's plugged in, and it will snap a picture. So this could be particularly useful if you want to take night shots or tripod shots with your iPhone, because pressing that button causes a little bit of wobble and you might end up with blur. But if you could set it up on a tripod and then use the remote, almost like a remote shutter, you can get real nice steady shots. It's going to be great for self-portraits also if you want to set up on a tripod. I'm hoping that someone will make some sort of extension cable that you can plug the Apple headphones in and give you a really long lead for a remote shutter button. And that would be really cool. Software updates over the air. The one thing about that is you now will be able to update multiple applications simultaneously, even over 3G. Again, if the carrier allows that. And what I mean by that is if you're used to updating your applications on your iOS device right now, you know that when you start the update, it downloads one application and installs it, and then downloads the next one and downloads the next one. If you have 10, 15, 20 applications to update, that can be a really slow process. Now you can have multiple streams, multiple updates happening simultaneously. So that does definitely speed up the process, and that was a welcome addition. The other thing is that syncing now, because it's over the air, or even when you're docked into iTunes, syncing you'll be able to still use your device as it is backing up and updating. So that's great for those of us who might use our iPads or iPhones as sort of secondary screens to maybe follow Twitter feeds and stuff like that. You can have it docked and syncing and also still be using those applications at the same time. You're not going to be locked out of it. So that was really cool to see. A lot more information on the new music app. Apple has now separated. It's no longer the iPod app, just like on the current iPod Touch. But the iPhone, the iPad, and the iPod Touch are all now going to have a video app for your videos, movies, and TV shows, and the music app for your podcasts, your music, your audiobooks, and stuff like that. And within that application, you now have a swipe to skip option, which you'll be able to swipe your album art left or right to jump between tracks. Cult of Mac reported on a new tap and hold feature in the music app that allows you to display additional track information like title, artist, album. Right now, it seems like it's only displaying that information, but presumably it would be able to add, you'd be able to add additional metadata, like maybe track length or bit rate, something like that. And I'm hoping that's something that we'll be able to control. Be great if there was a little setting where we could say, for the tap and hold feature, what information we want to show up when we do that, almost like doing a get info on the track in iTunes on the desktop. And there now is the ability to swipe and delete music on your iPod. So if you need to free up some room, this was something that you could do with podcasts, you could do with TV shows and movies. If you swipe on that on the current version of the iPod application or the music application, you can actually delete stuff, but you couldn't delete music off. You had to do that through iTunes. Now you can swipe to delete music, and I think that's because you can also now re-download that music over the air and get it back. So you can really remotely manage music all completely from your device, deleting it, removing it, and adding new stuff on. A lot of people are very excited. Video playback now supports 1080p video on iOS 5, both for decoding and encoding. So you'll be able to do full 1080p video. That's for A4 processors and better. But now that we have the HDMI out capabilities, that's going to be a welcome addition for really high quality video, people who want to be able to play that back on larger screens. The weather application now has something that I think it should have had all along. It's location-based. There's a location-based screen. So in addition to being able to add different cities that you might be traveling to or that you live in, you can now just swipe over to a location screen and it will give you the weather for your current area. And if you tap on the day or just the panel that's there, you now can get hour by hour weather for your current location, something that, again, I think is very useful and wasn't there before. I already mentioned that the whole PC-free metaphor has continued into network settings and setting up Airport Express base stations. It looks like to me that you can only configure a new unconfigured base station out of the box, which makes sense. So you plug in your new airport. This could be actually really useful for travelers. If you've ever taken your Airport Express base station with you and wanted to use that with your iPad, well, you couldn't do that unless you also brought along your Mac so that you could configure it for whatever network you're on. Now you'll be able to presumably use your iOS device to set up and configure that base station. Something that Apple quietly snuck into this release and really didn't tell anybody about, but has significant implications for subscriptions. We know that Apple has the new News Rack feature built into iOS 5 where you can get your magazine and newspaper subscriptions. It's not really a whole separate app. It's almost like a special folder. And you tap on it and it gives you that sort of iBooks bookshelf style interface, but that's where your magazine and newspaper subscriptions will go, and then they'll automatically come into that area as new issues come out or are released, and so you can go in and review and read your subscriptions. But one of the complaints when Apple announced their subscription program was that if you offered an in-app purchase, or if you offered the ability to buy a subscription outside of the App Store or outside of in-app purchasing, Apple made a restriction in the end user license agreement that said you also have to offer that subscription as an in-app purchase, and you have to offer that subscription at the same price or at a better price in-app. And that a lot of publishers were not happy about. There were big outcries about it, and some publishers said, well, we're not going to do iPad versions or iOS versions of our digital magazines or newspapers as subscriptions because of that restriction. Well, that has been changed with this latest release. Apple changed the language in there, and the new text now appears to allow for developers to offer subscription purchases outside of their app, as long as they don't put links to external websites in app. So that the actual text reads, apps can read or play approved content, specifically magazines, newspapers, books, audio, music, and video that is subscribed to or purchased outside of the app, as long as there's no button or external link in the app to purchase the approved content. So they kind of have to go one route or the other. If they want to do in-app purchase, then I think they still have to, they have the ability then to put a link that links out to an external site for subscriptions, but they're going to have to follow that rule of offering it at the same or better price as the in-app purchase. But if they don't want to have a link to any external content at all, and this probably covers things like Amazon Kindle, so you can go buy your Amazon Kindle books on the Amazon website and you could access those through the Amazon Kindle app. But if they want to have the ability to purchase, they need to do that as an in-app purchase within the application and offer it at the same or better pricing, or not have a link within the app at all to take you to an external site. So a little bit confusing maybe to the end user if you don't want to implement the in-app purchase, but at least publishers now have the option. They can either do it or not do it, and it's up to them. And I think that's going to help smooth things over and hopefully get more subscription content in News Rack and on the iOS devices. So I look forward to seeing that. There's also now a new warning, some new security feature that if you are on a fake GMS network, it will pop up an alert letting you know that you're on an unsecured cellular network. I didn't even know this was possible, but I guess there's something called an IMSI catcher that hackers can set up these fake GSM base stations, and your phone will try to connect to it thinking it's your cellular carrier and it's really something that's being run by a hacker. Well, the operating system will now alert you to that and tell you that your device is trying to access an unsecured cellular network, and I would presume at that point give you the ability or the opportunity to turn off 3G and get disconnected from that. And then Safari, finally we've got tab browsing, but also private browsing. So if that was a feature you had enjoyed on the desktop, the ability to, with the flick of a switch, turn off cookies and all the tracking information and stuff like that, and browser history, what have you, that is now built into the iOS as well. So a couple of, just a few dozen new features that you may have missed with iOS 5. I'm sure there's going to be more and more coming out every day, and I'll try and cover more and more of those on future episodes of the MacCast. Now on to Lion. Some of the features you may have missed from Lion, starting out with the requirements. Apple didn't go into, I don't think, during the keynote, the system requirements, unless I missed it. You are going to need an Intel Core 2 Duo or better. So if you're like me and you have one of the older Mac Minis, I have an Intel Core Duo Mac Mini, not Core 2 Duo. I'm not going to be able to upgrade to Lion on that one. It's too old, I guess, for that. Also, you need to have a minimum of 2 gigabytes of RAM. So that could be easily rectified. If you have an older system with a gig of RAM or less, you can just add some more RAM to that to get ready for your Lion upgrade. And right now, at the moment, it seems like you are going to need to be running Snow Leopard to get the upgrade. This is causing a little bit of an uproar for a lot of people, and actually some concern. I have some concern because historically when Apple releases a new version of the operating system, they don't make the old version available for sale. So if you don't have Snow Leopard, you're not going to be able to have the App Store, and the only way to get Lion is through the Mac App Store as a digital download, or at least that's what Apple is saying right now. The hope is that they're going to offer up some alternatives, maybe have a retail box version available in the App Store, but based on what they said at the keynote, that's not seeming like the direction they're going, and it doesn't seem very likely. So you do need to have Snow Leopard running to be able to get the upgrade. So if you haven't upgraded to Snow Leopard and you want to run Lion, just something to think about. You might want to keep an eye on the blogs, and I will definitely, if I find out differently, mention it on the MacCast that there's going to be an upgrade path for, say, Leopard users. But right now, you need to be running Snow Leopard, so you might want to pick up your upgrade now, even if you don't install it. They are going to have a Lion up-to-date program, so if you did purchase a new Mac on or after June 6th, they're going to provide details on how you can get a free copy of Lion, a free upgrade to Lion. You have 30 days after the release of macOS 10 Lion to claim your upgrade. They'll have details on a page on Apple's website. It's apple.com/macOS10/up-to-date. Right now, it's just a placeholder page, but eventually when Lion is released, they should have details on how you can claim your Lion up-to-date copy. So if you've bought a new Mac, watch for that. If you're like me and you set up your Mac so that on boot up, it goes to the login screen and requires login, and I recommend that most people do that because I think it's a good security measure. Don't have it auto log in just in case your laptop gets stolen, something like that. Have it go to the lock screen and have it set up so you need to enter a password. If you do that, you're probably familiar with the fact that you can restart the Mac or shut it down, but it's sounding like in Lion there's a new mode where you'll be able to reboot into Safari. So it almost becomes like a little kiosk and you can get web access and internet access. Sounding like one of the reasons for that might be so that a would-be thief would start up the Mac, realize they can't get in because they don't know your password, but may boot it up into Safari mode, and that would give the notebook a chance to phone home for the Find My Mac feature. That seems a little bit extreme for me. I think it's more likely that Apple wanted to provide a kiosk mode for retailers, and then potentially also just the ability. I've often wanted the ability, if a guest comes to my house, to be able to set up a Mac for them and give them the ability to web surf, maybe check their email from a web browser, something like that, but not have to give them full access to an entire system. And this provides a nice, easy way for doing that. So that's a nice new feature that we didn't hear Apple talk about at the keynote. A big question that a lot of people have, because Lion is going to be a digital download only, is what about booting? What if I need to do an emergency boot? What if I need to build a boot disk? How am I going to do that? And luckily, some options have been discovered. No official word from Apple. I'm hoping that Apple makes a nice, seamless, easy way to do this. There's one method that they've built in that is kind of like that, but I think has a fatal flaw. So the different ways that you can emergency boot from your Mac. The first one that's kind of built in is when you install Lion, apparently it creates a special partition, emergency boot partition on whatever drive that you install it on. And you can see this if you go into Disk Utility, you'll see this little extra partition, and you can restart the Mac, hold down the Option key to go into the EFI boot mode, and then select this partition and boot up from it. But the fatal flaw with that is that if your hard drive fails, you may or may not be able to actually get to that partition. So what are you going to do if you need to boot the Mac and you need to do it from an external drive or some other media like a DVD? Well, it doesn't look like Apple has built in any automated way for that to happen. My hope is that during the install process, maybe toward the end, they'll give you an option that says, would you like to create an emergency boot disk, and then give you the ability to insert a DVD, or better yet, use a USB drive to build an emergency boot disk that you can boot from and then reinstall the operating system. Some clever hackers and people have figured out, though, that you can actually do this on your own. I think the easiest way to do it is to take the disk image that you download from the Mac App Store, that DMG file, and using Disk Utility, you can use their repair option to create basically a copy, an image, bootable image of that, or bootable disk from that image. So that's pretty easy to do. That's been functionality that's been around in Mac OS X for a while using Disk Utility. So you could do that. You can burn it to DVD or USB drive or flash drive, something like that. And a number of people have reported success in doing that with the current builds of Lion. Another way you can do it, something that I think came out on Cult of Mac, or at least that's where I saw the report, is right now you can open the Lion installer package, do the right click thing and do show package contents, and there's a folder in there called shared support folder, and then there's a little DMG file called install.esd.dmg. And again, you can use Disk Utility with that image to create a bootable DVD or external drive. So definitely there's a couple ways if you want to hack in there to do this, but the ultimate hope is that Apple builds in default functionality for this. But since so many of you have been asking about that, I thought I'd cover those different methods for you. And then the last thing that I just want to comment on with respect to Lion is just how much Apple is really focusing on multi-touch within the desktop. I know we've heard rumors, and Apple has some patent designs for a touch-based desktop system, iMac. I still think that's a kind of a kludgy thing, but Apple, I think, is very much thinking about it, and I think we're starting to see with how much multi-touch is being integrated into Lion, some of their thought processes on how that might work. For now, I think it's really focused on the trackpads. So both the Magic Trackpad and the trackpad that's built into the desktops, or the notebooks, excuse me. But I think we're seeing that Apple is sort of, you know, they mentioned demoting the Mac to being just a device. I think they're kicking the mouse to the curb, it seems like. The reports are saying that there are going to be some ways to set up some keyboard shortcuts for and do some mapping of some of the multi-touch gestures to keyboard shortcuts. But really, I think to get the most power out of a lot of the features that are going to be built into Lion, I think you really are going to want a trackpad. So that might mean that when you're thinking about your Lion upgrade, you might consider setting some money aside to getting a Magic Trackpad. So you're looking at another $80 US to add to your upgrade price. So just be thinking about that. And, you know, you're obviously still going to be able to use a standard mouse and keyboard with the operating system, but to get full, to take full advantage of mission control and some of the other gesture-based things that Apple is doing with the operating system, you are going to probably want to have a trackpad. It's definitely going to be a consideration. So I guess that's maybe Steve Jobs' way of completely getting rid of buttons, is just go, you know what, we're going to have trackpads, and that's going to multi-touch. That's the way we're going to do everything. The other interesting thing, I guess one more thing on OS X Lion. One thing that wasn't brought up was any mention of AirPrint capabilities being built into the printer sharing on Lion. Really nice feature of iOS is AirPrint, the ability to print from your iOS devices. And I think in some ways it's not surprising that Apple isn't building AirPrint into the shared printing technology if you think about this focus on being PC-free, because using AirPrint through printer sharing on the Mac means that you're, again, tying your iOS devices to a desktop computer. So I think more likely what we're going to see is Apple building AirPrint technology into base stations, into the Airport Express maybe, which would be an ideal solution. So you can plug in your Airport Express. It has AirPrint technology built into it, and any USB printer that you plug into it automatically has the ability to support AirPrint. I think that's more the direction that they're going to be going. The good news is there's still apps out there like Printopia from Ecamm that will allow you to use your Mac as a conduit for AirPrint functionality. And that's good news for the third-party developers. There's an opportunity there. But I think Apple is really saying, you know what, we're going to rely on printers that have AirPrint technology built in, or Wi-Fi base station technologies that have AirPrint technology built in. We're not going to require you to have a Mac as the conduit or the center of your digital hub. The digital hub is being moved to the network, to the cloud, and that continues this focus. So I really wasn't surprised by that, but a couple people mentioned the missing AirPrint this week, so I thought I'd bring that up. And that's kind of what I had for what's built into iOS 5 and Lion and wasn't announced at the WWDC keynote. There's a ton of other features. I'm sure I've missed some. If you have some of your favorite features you'd like to share with the MacCast community, please send in your comments, send in your thoughts and observations, what you like about what was announced, what you don't like about what was announced. If you're excited about iCloud, if you hate iCloud, or you're worried about MobileMe, send all of that information, maccast@gmail.com, or call in on the listener hotline. I'll give you the information on how to do that at the end of the show. A few other items to cover, some tips and tricks. One, I got a tip from John. He was dealing with moving some pretty large files around using, or trying to move some pretty large files around using flash drives, and ran into some troubles, but found a way around it, or a solution that's built into Mac OS X that you might not be aware of. So here's John with a little tip.
Hey, Adam. This is John Krikorian from Las Vegas, Nevada. I love the MacCast. I have a tip that I thought your listeners might be interested in. I had to do some video editing on my MacBook for a work project. So I brought my MacBook to work, and I was doing some video editing on it, and I had to transfer the files back and forth to my work computer, which is a Windows machine. And of course, I didn't want to have to do all that over the network because the files were just huge. So I thought I would just use an external USB drive. The problem I had is the video files were so gigantic, I couldn't transfer them properly with the FAT file format or the NTFS format. With the NTFS format from Windows, I could only read the files on the Mac. And with the FAT file format, I was running into a 4 gigabyte file limitation, which is not that big when it comes to video files, as I'm sure anybody who's done any video editing is aware. So I Googled around a little bit, and I discovered that there's a new format available for hard drives called the XFAT file format. It's actually pretty neat. It's built into Mac OS X Snow Leopard under the disk utility. You can just go in there and format your external hard drives and just select XFAT. And it's also available for Windows. It's built into Windows Vista Service Pack 1 and Windows 7. And it's also available for Windows XP with a download from the Microsoft website. And it's a file format that allows you to have read and write ability on Mac and Windows without a 4 gigabyte file limitation, which the FAT file format gives you. It is just very cool, very easy, very simple, and I thought all your listeners would appreciate knowing about it. Thanks for the MacCast, Adam. Have a good one. Bye.
Hey, thanks, John. Yep, that is really good to know about. I remember Apple commenting on that when they added that. I think they added it under Snow Leopard. Yeah, it was part of the 10.6.5 update under Snow Leopard. They added the XFAT support. And XFAT stands for Extended File Allocation Table, also sometimes referred to as FAT64. It was originally developed by Microsoft, or was developed by Microsoft, and was something that they were targeting for USB flash drives and flash memory cards. And as you pointed out, it gets past the 4 gigabyte file size limit that's built into FAT32, which most USB keys and flash drives you buy these days come pre-formatted in FAT32, because as you mentioned, you get read-write capability both on the Mac side and on the PC side, so it makes them the most useful for transferring files back and forth between systems. But if you've got really large video files or larger files, and files seem to get bigger and bigger every day, even some image files with the new, you know, 12, 21 megapixel cameras are getting rather large. Photoshop files can get really big too. Then you need a way to get around that limitation, and XFAT sort of solves that problem. And you're right, it is built into disk utility, so you can reformat that drive, flash drive, or in your case, an external hard drive in the new format and gain that capability back. So great tip. Thanks for sending that along. And I'm sure there's some people out there that have run into this limitation that'll benefit from that. And then finally, today, I want to leave you with a tip related to some of the new iCloud functionality that Apple has announced. You know, developers are getting to take advantage of that. If you're in the Mac developer program or the iOS developer program, you can sign up for iCloud and you can start playing around with some of the new services. But it's all in beta. It's all early stage stuff. But Apple did release some of the features of the new iTunes iCloud to us a little bit early. Apple released the update to iTunes 10.3, and there was actually a subsequent update to 10.3.1. It came out pretty quickly. So get your iTunes upgraded to 10.3.1, and you can start to take advantage of some of these features, including the ability to have automatically pushed to your Macs and your devices any of your iTunes purchases. So this is really convenient. It's something you could enable through home sharing. I'll mention how you do that here in a second, but now you have the ability, if I buy something on my iPhone, I can set it up so that the minute that I buy and download it on my iPhone, it's also automatically downloaded and placed into my iTunes library on my Mac and my iPad and anything basically tied into my Apple iTunes store account. So you do need to be logged in and registered on all your devices using the same Apple Store ID. And in iOS 4.3, this feature was, I guess, automatically pushed out. I guess Apple's already got some of that automatically downloading stuff in there, but it was just suddenly enabled on my device. If you go into settings into the App Store, or excuse me, the iTunes store settings, you'll notice there's an automatic downloads section now, and you can set it up to automatically download music, apps, or books. And there's also, if you're on a 3G device, an option to force it to only use Wi-Fi, or you can have it also use the cellular data network. And that's good, because if you're on, you know, capped plan, you might want to only enable these downloads over Wi-Fi. But if you turn that on or set up that automatic download, any purchases made on iTunes will be automatically pushed to that device. In iTunes on the Mac, same thing, 10.3 3.1. Make sure you're up to date on that. And then go into the iTunes preferences, into the store tab. And again, you'll see automatic downloads at the top, and you can set up automatic downloads for music, apps, or books. And it all happens almost instantaneously. I tried this on my home network, and the minute I purchased a file, I tried it, and it actually works with free content too. So I just used some of the iTunes free content. The minute I started downloading one of those free files, it immediately started pushing to my desktop when I made the purchase on my iPhone. And it was pretty cool to see. Right now, it looks like it doesn't support movies or TV shows yet. And also, I've read reports that the music feature isn't supported outside the US yet. It's likely due to licensing. So don't shoot the messenger. I'm sorry if you're not in the US and can't play with this feature. Sounds like maybe iBooks might work, though, and apps also have the ability to do this, so you can at least play around with those two. I don't typically like to have every app that I purchase synced to all of my devices, all of my iOS devices, but if you like to enable that feature, it is there, and it definitely works, and works very seamlessly. The other thing about this is that this over-the-air syncing works on up to 10 different devices, and up to five of those can be Macs. So if you have 6 Macs, you're gonna have to rule one out, but that should be plenty for most people. Another thing about this, as I mentioned earlier, it is tied to a single iTunes account, so all of the devices have to be on the same iTunes account. And if you want to switch the iTunes account on a device for this feature, there's a 90-day waiting period to be able to reassociate the auto downloads. So this could be a big issue if you're a multiple iTunes account family. You have different Macs and different devices using different iTunes accounts, and you want to share stuff. You're probably going to have to do that the old traditional ways that you've been doing. You're not going to be able to enable this auto downloading. It really seems like this only applies to the auto downloading or the re-downloading of content. This restriction only applies to that. You still can use multiple accounts to actually authorize music on the device. This is for the older DRM content. So that's not going to break here. But if you want to switch which account you're auto downloading from, I guess once you do the switch, you got to wait 90 days before the feature starts working, which could be a little bit inconvenient. You just need to be aware of that. As I mentioned, home sharing options still work locally. We've talked about the home sharing features and the ability to auto sync content across your home network. If you buy on one Mac or one device and then have it automatically sync over from one iTunes library to the other, the way you get this to work is you need to have home sharing turned on for all of the Macs on your network. And then when you're in home sharing, go under the shared list, select the Mac that you want to manage, and then click the sharing button down at the bottom of the main window, the settings button down at the bottom of the main window. And then you can set automatic transfers of music, movies, TV shows, books, or apps across your network. So this works locally. It's not a cloud service. It's not a push service. It just means that if I buy content on one Mac and I have this feature enabled on the other Mac, any of my purchases can be automatically transferred and put into that library. So it helps keep all of your purchased music in sync. And again, because home sharing works all off the same Apple ID, it is kind of locked into all of the Macs being sharing the same iTunes account. The other thing that iTunes 10.3 brought that I want to point out is iBooks. iBooks had been something that you had to buy through the iBookstore app on your iOS device up until iTunes 10.3. Now, if you go into the iTunes store, you can actually go to, there's a new books section, and you can buy your iBooks through iTunes and have them synced up to your different devices. The one thing Apple didn't add, and I don't know why they haven't done this yet, is any kind of ability to read an ebook on your Mac with an Apple built-in ebook reader. I would think it'd be something they could easily add to Preview, the ability to read ebooks, but right now you still need to use a third-party app on your Mac to do that, or sync it over to your iOS device and use the iBooks application. Another iCloud feature that actually Apple auto-magically enabled, I don't know. I guess this works because, again, iTunes Store is essentially a web app, but they turned on the previous purchases option, or the re-downloading of tracks or content previously purchased content from the cloud, or the iCloud, I guess we have to call it now. So if you go into the iTunes Store application, either through iTunes or on iOS, there's now a new purchased area or purchases area. And in the iTunes Store, when you go into the iTunes Store, it's over on the sidebar. On iOS, it's a little tab down at the bottom of the application. You can go in and you can review all of the music that you had purchased previously. And even more handy, there's a little tab at the top that says not on this Mac or not on this iPod or not on this iPhone, depending on which device you're using. And you can see all of the previously purchased content that is not currently on that device. And then it gives you the option with the little cloud icon to re-download that content all for free. And so I played around with this a little bit, and it works really great, kind of seamless. There was one little issue that I ran into. I've had my content for a really long time, and any of you who've been around long enough might remember back in the day, iTunes, when it had FairPlay on it, there were some methods for removing the FairPlay DRM technology. I had done that to some of my tracks, some of my albums, and those albums showed up as not being installed on my device or not being synced to my device. So it didn't recognize my tracks as the ones that I had purchased from iTunes. And that resulted, when I did some re-downloading, in some duplicates. The other thing I discovered was that when I re-downloaded those, they were in the older format. So I was expecting them to be the higher quality 256 iTunes Plus content, but they weren't. They were the original protected AAC 128 kilobit files. So I'm guessing that you can't get at the newer, higher bitrate content until Apple has launched its new iTunes Match service, which you're going to have to pay, you know, $25 a year for. And I did also notice that the ability to upgrade my tracks to my older purchased tracks to iTunes Plus is still there in the iTunes Store. You do that for, I think, 30 cents a track. So to do my whole library, it's several hundred dollars for me. I think I'm going to wait until the iTunes Match service comes out and just sign up for the $25 a year plan and then upgrade my music at that point. So just, if you've been holding off on upgrading your iTunes music to iTunes Plus, you might want to wait a little bit while longer. I just noticed that when I was using the re-download features. So that's some stuff that's already enabled in iTunes, and you can kind of take advantage of that now. The little parts of the Apple iTunes iCloud, and I think it's going to be one of these services that they're going to be continuing to work on and pushing out new services and improving services and stuff like that. But right now, I'm very excited about everything that was announced at WWDC. I'm really excited to get my hands on Lion, really excited to get my hands on the next version of iOS 5 and start playing around with iCloud. I'm sure you are as well. Again, please send in your feedback, your comments, and what have you. And that's going to do it for this week. A supersized episode, kind of making up for some lost time from last week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, you know what? You can get cash for that old iPod, that old iPhone, if you're looking to do an upgrade, maybe your old MacBook, MacBook Pro, whatever. Go on gazelle.com, do a search. They'll give you a straight upfront offer of cash for your used electronics. You don't have to deal with auction sites or selling on classifieds, anything like that. Check it out, gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, check out their software and get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile Software, they make PDF pen, text expander, disk label. I rely on their software each and every day. Great stuff. You can find out more information as well as get demos over at smilesoftware.com. And Stitcher, check out the free Stitcher Radio app. You can get access to podcasts and radio stations all streaming without having to deal with the hassles of downloading or syncing your device. And right now, if you sign up using the code MACCAST after downloading the app, you'll be entered to win an iPad 2, entered in the contest to win an iPad 2. So do that. You can get information and details at stitcher.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. If you'd like to further support the show, don't forget about the MacCast member program. You can sign up to get additional MacCast content each and every week just for a couple bucks a month, about the cost of a coffee these days, a fancy coffee like a latte, about $4 a month depending on which plan you pick. I have month-to-month, six-month, and year plans. You can get more information and details over at member.maccast.com. I just did a whole episode. A number of people had been asking me about Rosetta not being available in Lion, and what are your options if you need to run some of those older applications. So I cover that information, and there's 84 other episodes that you can dive into. The full archive is available. Once you become a member, you can log in and you can go to the archive section and download any episode you want. Also, feeds, of course, are available, and you can subscribe in iTunes or some of the newer iOS podcasting clients like Downcast, which is my current favorite for accessing protected AAC feeds. So get all the information and details at member.maccast.com. Check that out, and I appreciate everybody who's become a MacCast member and is helping support the show. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love getting feedback from you. I'm sure you have lots of comments about what was announced at WWDC. If you have a question, a concern, something you want to know more information about, send those along. Maccast@gmail.com is the email address, or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there or voicemail on Skype. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if you do leave a voicemail, please leave your email address. And if you can spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. We just moved servers and things seem to be performing really well. If you haven't been on the MacCast forum in a while, it's nice and snappy now. So check it out, forum.maccast.com. Great MacCast community, a bunch of people hanging out there answering all kinds of questions and technical details. They are a smart bunch, so take advantage of that resource. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. All right, that's going to do it for today. I think we're getting close to 2 hours if we're not over it yet. So we're going to forego the new music for this week, but I'll be back next week with more MacCast. And until then, I'll talk to you all again real soon.